I upset that I didn't go to the Shadowrunners convention this week in Indianapolis? No. Why? Why would I want to see all those guys again? Just saw them a few months ago. Sure, it was fun. Yeah, there was a lot of really awesome stuff there. But you know what? Shadowrunning is more than just meeting together at a convention. Shadowrunning is a way of life. A means by which we can subvert an unjust system. Something that brings together rebels from every walk of life and every race. Shadowrunning is the primary way in which we sinless folk spark the revolution of the mind and play the corporations and nations against each other. Without Shadowrunners and Shadowruns, the corpse would already have won. Okay, I am a little bit jealous. But let me tell you, if I was in Indianapolis, I would have missed out on all the dreck that went down in one of Seattle's big gangs this week. Big change is afoot in the Seattle gang scene. Coming to you straight from the most reliably biased source on the Matrix, this is the Anarchy in Podcasting Network, and I am Opti. Welcome to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. We are plowing straight forward into the ripe field in time to harvest the nuggets of truth in the year 2062. Crows, some of the stuff is from the deep end of the pool, so simply listening to it may get you into some hot water. You have been warned. First up, the geopolitical lowdown. January sees Aztlan placed armed troops into their section of Denver, which violates the Treaty of Denver. In reaction, the leaders of Denver's other sectors do the same. All of this activity leads the Great Dragon Ghostwalker to call a meeting of the Council of Denver on January 27th. During this meeting, the Council votes to give control of Denver to Ghostwalker. His first act as ruler is to give control of Aztlan's sector of Denver to the CAS, followed up by an order for all Aztlan businesses and personnel to leave the city, or else. The remaining sectors, including the CAS, the Pueblo Corporate Council, the Sioux Nation, and the UCAS, all contribute troops to the newly formed Zone Defense Force, which answers directly to Ghostwalker. On the other side of the world, on January 3rd, 2062, the Unzen Volcano erupts and has the unfortunate legacy of killing the entire Japanese imperial family, except for Yasuhito, who was only 14 years old. 2 days later, he is named Emperor of Japan, starting what is known as the Genyu era. The following month, Emperor Yasuhito undoes the Yomi Island Decree, allowing metahumans in Japan freedom from mandatory deportation to Yomi Island. Those metahumans already on Yomi are released and are then free to return to Japan. It was also this month that the Hook revolutionaries declare revolution from Japan in the Philippines. Aztlan had a very eventful year in 2062. The nation must have been feeling rather deflated after Ghostwalker kicked them out of Denver, costing them not only economically, but also putting them in a position of perceived weakness compared to the other Treaty of Denver nations. So they did what any nation does when their ego is bruised. They divert attention from their weaknesses and attempt to show strength in unrelated sectors. First, and in case you don't remember, here's some background to this next story. Ever since 2050 or so, rebellion had been stirring in the Aztlan region of Yucatan. In 2051, Campeche rebels in the Yucatan Peninsula began making raids against the Aztlan military. In 2052, Aztlan sent even more troops, which escalated the violence on both sides. In 2054, rebels in Yucatan bombed an Azzi oil refinery. And in 2055, a full-blown civil war broke out in the Yucatan Peninsula, which lasted for years, and in 2056, Yucatan rebels accidentally destroy a ferry with 200 civilian passengers, giving Aztlan an advantage in the media theater of war. So, after more than a decade of conflict, Aztlan slash S Technology decides they want to end this rebellion once and for all. And on February 5th, 2062, using many of the troops they recalled from Denver, they begin attacking rebels on the Yucatan using a slash-and-burn strategy, turning the once-fertile area into a wasteland. It looked like the Azzis were going to win the war by attrition, but in March of 2062, a new player entered the conflict. Nature. On March 15th, earthquakes, massive storms, tsunamis, and nature spirits unleash their collective wrath against the Yucatan forces. This, of course, halts the Aztlan offensive, but unravels into another full-blown conflict between nature spirits and the toxic spirits which had taken up residence. Aztlaners and rebels alike are killed as collateral damage in the Spirit War, which, at least for the time being, caused Aztlan to sit on the sidelines of the conflict. But Aztlan was busy in other parts of the world as well. Once again, a recap of the facts leading up to Aztlan's actions in 2062. In 2034, three great dragons, including Hualpa, Sarurg, and possibly Arleash, amass and lead an army of awakened creatures and metahumans, taking over most of South America, renaming it Amazonia. In 2049, Amazonia annexes all of Venezuela and a sizable chunk of Colombia in response to Aztlan's growing empire. In 2050, Aztlan gets bold and sends its forces into Amazonia-owned Venezuela to seize it by force. They succeed, which only makes them more bold. The border skirmishes between Aztlan and Amazonia continue for a while, but eventually calm down to a mere low-level hatred. Later in 2050, Colombia decides they need to choose sides, and so they petition Aztlan and are granted membership in Aztlan's empire. And that is when official hostilities between Amazonia and Aztlan turn into more Cold War tactics. So it's a well-established fact that these two nations hate each other, and this hatred blinds them from mutually beneficial diplomatic options. Just because there wasn't open war going on doesn't mean there wasn't fighting. It simply became a proxy war with the population of Bogota, which is right on the border of Amazonia and Aztlan, becoming the pawns in their life and death chess game. There were many atrocities and aggressions that almost erupted the conflict into full-scale war again, but other priorities and emergencies put that off for a while. Nevertheless, tensions continue to spike, fueled by reckless and hateful actions on both sides. During the Year of the Comet, it was not only metahumans, but other flora and fauna that surged as well, gaining unique properties and changing the ecosystem of South America. At first, this phenomenon was misunderstood as a purposeful threat by each side of this conflict, and so both sides made preparations for retaliation. So, wanting to prove themselves after the loss of face in Denver, and in spite of ramping up the hostilities in the Yucatan, Aztlan struck first at Amazonia when it began seeding the rainforest borders of Bogota with Sangre de Diablo trees, which are a rare surge tree, carnivorous. The bark and sap of the Sangre del Diablo trees are deep red in color, and the trees are highly resistant to fire and magic as well. They also have bark like hardened armor. As if that wasn't scary enough, the trees are carnivorous and exert some sort of low-level mind control over those who get too close. Then it has the ability to grab them with its branches and uses corrosive sap to melt its victims into food. Aztlan decided that these deadly trees would make the best defensive perimeter against Amazonia and spent the better part of 2062 planting as many as they could. Unfortunately, the deadly trees fed off the rapid growth of the awakening rainforest and quickly took over, killing off nearly all other forms of native plant and animals. Even now, many parts of Bogota are uninhabitable. I wouldn't go there on a bet, crows. Of course, Amazonia was filled with rage at having their home rainforest desecrated like this, and they brought down a mighty wrath onto Bogota. While not officially called a war, the overt violence between Amazonia and Aztlan lasts for the next decade. Moving on from Aztlan's retribution, March sees Halley's Comet on its return pass, once again becoming visible to the naked eye, until disappearing once again on April 1st. After the comet disappears, the naturally occurring orichalcum, which had previously been discovered, runs dry, and no new deposits are found. New cases of surge do get reported afterwards, but the numbers are minuscule compared to the cases reported in 61 and 62. The next month, in May, after the rest of the world is starting to move on from comet fever, Chernenog discovers that the veil that had surrounded it since its inception is no longer functioning according to design. While they have never admitted it publicly, some of my sources say that the Danyon Drail, fierce magic storms around the Shire, collided with the Veil during the Year of the Comet and corrupted it, causing it to act erratically ever after. Others have said that the surge and the recession of mana in the wake of the comet simply threw off the balance of mana within the Veil itself. Either way, the Veil no longer created an impenetrable force field around the island, only letting in those who belonged. Now it is an erratic force field, which works sometimes, and if you get caught halfway in between it, well, it hurts. Because of the failings of the Veil, Chernenog could no longer afford to continue its isolationist stance. Furthermore, dangerous mana spikes and, more frightening for the Shire leadership, mana voids, began appearing at random within the Veil. Astral constructs known as Alkera began appearing with increasing frequency. These Alkera are astral forms manifesting on the material realm. Often they appear and disappear just as quickly. Sometimes they appear for a while and vanish weeks or even months later. In rare circumstances, these Alkera look like they're here to stay. I've heard rumors of intrepid explorers entering Alkera to research, but when the Alkera vanished once more, it took the researchers with it, never to be heard from again. So be careful out there, crows. Needless to say, this development put the citizens of Chernanog into serious self-reflection and put the Danann families on high alert. Also in May, the Elven Manitou form their own council and break away from the Algonquian Council's authority. The Manitou take all the land north of the Churchill River as their own. Shaking up the north even further, on May 2nd, Tsimshian troops invade the Salashi from their northern border. The Tsimshian troops are pushed back past the border into their own territory. Salish troops then begin to report massive casualties from what appears to be a biological weapon. The Tsimshian nation denies responsibility and is quick to add that many of their own troops were affected as well. Just a few days after the assault began, a ceasefire is declared between the two northern nations on May 5th. Unfortunately, the ceasefire is broken in July in a series of attacks by unsettled Salish military groups. Also in July, Quebec's Republic starts allowing English to be used on a trial basis and only for business transactions. Finally, in October, despite no seismic activity whatsoever, the island of Lyonesse appears in the English Channel right at the convergence of the Stalker and Stonehenge ley lines. It is, at least for those in Europe, one of the most stunning events of 2062. UK military immediately cordoned off and took control of the island. The Royal Navy and at least four Great Form Elementals protect anybody from accessing the island. The island, if you recall, was, according to Arthurian legend, an island that sank but will rise again at the return of King Arthur. I, for one, don't want him to come back. In corporation news, in the spring, Ares finally lands a probe on Halley's Comet during its second pass. Ares, due to this event, wins the probe race. Yay. Now, Crows, this may not seem very important at the moment, but I'm bringing it up now for dramatic tension and foreshadowing. It was in 2062 that the nanotechnology firm Microfleck, founded by Asatru practitioner Jorgen Masterson, was bought out by Zeta Impkem. Masterson was fatefully placed in Zeta Impkem's research department. Remember that, Crows. In Shadow News, 2062 sees a syndicate war in Hong Kong between the Yellow Lotus Triads and the Red Dragon Association. By the way, Crows, keep your eyes open later this month for that Tridio game about Shadowrunners in Hong Kong. Old Opti makes a cameo. Now this next bit concerns Shir Tarangira and has a lot to do with dragons as well. In June of 2062, without warning, both Aethni Oakforest and the Great Dragon Lothair both retire from the Shir Tarangira Council of Princes. The question everyone has been asking since is why? Why would two of the most powerful beings on the planet leave such powerful positions? Well, Crows, you've come to the right place, as usual. In fact, this is likely the only place you will hear this. And Crows, needless to say, this is one of those times where simply hearing this info will be hazardous to your health. So, Aethne Oakforest, Prince of the Shire, had this son named Glasgian Oakforest. And this kid was a world-class hoophole. In 2051, Glasgian and this other elven hoopbuster named Walter Eardley use a magic artifact to locate and destroy a hidden cache of dragon eggs. Unfortunately, this clutch of eggs was under the protection of Lothair, and for those paying attention at home, this is almost certainly the reason that Lothair gained placement on the Shire Council, so that he could either guard the remaining clutch from the elves, or exact retribution, or both. Glasgian further went on to make an idiot of himself by making an unseemly proposal to Aina Dupree, and getting himself traumatized by the whole mouth. Following Dunkelzahn's death, Aethne Oakforest sent Lothair a token of sympathy, but Lothair, apparently still sore over his clutch, rejected this show of sympathy and returned the token by dropping it back to him, from 5,000 feet up. Word is that it missed Glasgian by only a few feet. Bottom line is, Glasgian was a big embarrassment to his father. Now, in early 2062, Glasgian went missing. In addition to that, the Shire had begun to have massive economic problems. Issues with too many imports and not enough exports began to cause everyone who wasn't rich and powerful in the Shire to desire change. Enter the Renel Kitesra. Remember them? The disparate group of rebels that had started to band together to protest the Council of Princes? Well, they had been gaining traction in the last few years, lots of it. Did I mention that the Renel was supported by the Great Dragon and the Elf? So, all of that leads up to what my crows have been telling me. That the Great Dragon Hestabe kidnapped Glasgian. And, if what I'm being told is true, she traded him to Lothair, who was more than happy to give up his seat on the Shire Council of Princes in return. And, in a bit of grisly retribution, the reason that no one has seen Glasgian since is that Lothair ate him, right then and there, as soon as the deal was finalized. got what was coming to him, if you ask me. Anyway, that's why Lothir vacated, and Aethne Oakforest likely bailed because the Shire was becoming rather hostile for him. In July, Lew Shurhand predictably offers Lothir's vacant seat to Hestabee, who accepts. Aethne fumed about this at his royal home for some time before deciding to leave Shire Tarangire altogether for the distant shores of Shir Nanogue. The next upset in the Shire happens when Aeron the Scribe declares that he is also abandoning his seat on the council by the end of the year in order to accept a chair at the Dunkelzahn Institute of Magical Research. The remaining conservative princes, including Sean Laverty, Jenna Nefera, Lew Shurhand, and Sosin Nairain, are paralyzed into inaction by the strides that the Rennell Kateserra rebellion continues to make. Looking back, the Rennell had its biggest surge of support in 2062, and was also when the Rennell groups began to act with a more singular purpose. Now, in addition to meddling with the affairs of elves, the dragons did quite a bit more in 2062. Now, the great dragon Hestabee, the one who got the seat on Shire Tarangire's council, did so at the expense of goodwill in California. Really quick, since Hestabee only becomes more important, I want to talk about her a bit. She's the western one with the copper scales that goes by Orange Queen on the Matrix. She had her lair on Mount Shasta in Calfrey, and they've been protecting California from Shire Tarangire since 2053, which is why they felt like it was a betrayal to have her join forces to the nation that had been trying to invade them for over a decade. It could be that she thought that she could do more good on the council and protect the world better if she kept her enemies closer. Then again, she is a dragon, and who knows what plans she is making. She seems to have taken over Dunkelzahn's interest in caring for metahumanity, and she is not nearly as insufferable as the others, but big D, she is not. She did have a few pretty high-profile closed-door meetings with the Draco Foundation, Lothir, and Ghostwalker following Dunkelzahn's passing. She does support the Orcs' Rights Committee, the American Association for the Advancement of Thaumaturgy, is the primary sponsor of the Astral Space Preservation Society, and she bankrolls a bunch of environmental extremist groups. In particular, her lair on Mount Shasta is home to an enormously powerful shamanic lodge, and is protected by gypsies, many otaku-turned-technomancers, local centaurs, and other awakened creatures. Keep an eye on her, Crows. She not only steps more into the spotlight as time goes on. Later in 2062, the Great Dragons hold some sort of conclave or secret meeting with all of their kind. As far as I'm able to suss out, this was the first such meeting since the World Awakened. Apparently, Dunkelzahn held a particular role amongst dragonkind called Loremaster. The dragon called Loremaster holds a great deal of knowledge and power in the dragon community. As a result, the struggle between the Great Dragons to become the next Loremaster was fierce. I know at least Hestabee and Lothir were leading candidates for Loremaster, but I hear there was another Dark Horse candidate as well in the German dragon Nachtmeister, who had already begun to call himself the Loremaster. The rules for winning the title were similar to the ancient elven challenge described as the Kalhan. Apparently the Jewel of Memory from Dunkelzahn's will was also involved, which Lothir initially possessed after Big D's demise. Eventually, Hestabee becomes the new dragon Loremaster, and with it, possessed the Jewel of Memory. In addition to this bit of news, I've been sitting on a pirated trid that came out of Frankfurt, Germany. The audio is messed up, but the video clearly shows Lothir in an hours-long duel with Nachtmeister, which Lothir eventually wins when Nachtmeister plummets to the ground in flames. And I've been informed that Nachtmeister had been intentionally scheming against Golden Snout for some time, and the Frankfurt Bank was the only real competition that Satterkrupp had in the region. Of course, Nachtmeister controlled that bank, and along with Nachtmeister claiming to be Loremaster so brazenly, that's what I estimate led Lothir to so publicly call out Nachtmeister to a duel and killed him over the Frankfurt skies. Don't deal with dragons, Crows. Just don't do it. Rounding out 2062, here are some magical tidbits. In January, the CAS began to offer bounties for mages who reanimate corpses. Now, this was done in reaction to the Shadim scare. Most mages who reanimate dead aren't Shadim-related, though I do think they are unfairly targeting certain magical traditions. Now, I won't say that I want my friends or family rising from the grave, nor would I care to have rising from the grave become commonplace, but I do know some mojo slingers who do voodoo that are good chummers. Unfortunately, most of those who raise the dead in traditions that aren't related to Shadim are ethnic. All of which to say that the CAS used scare tactics to put yet another law in place that indirectly targets minorities for persecution. Thankfully, things like this didn't happen in the Fifth World, only today. And in June of 2062, at Devil's Tower in the Sioux Nation, the participants of the Sun Dance began having intense visions. Some mysteriously disappear. Now, every year since, many dancers report strong visions during the Sun Dance. Now, I'll tell you that the Sun Dance involves voluntary bloodletting, and while there have not been any accusations of blood magic, it is my belief that even willing, participatory, non-lethal blood spilling while a magic ritual's going on is uber dangerous, little crows. Jackdaw was there when it happened, and he swears that Wolf made an appearance and swallowed some of the dancers whole. And while I will never swallow you whole, little crows, you have still put yourself in danger by wasting an entirely good slot of time listening to the Anarchy and Podcasting Network. In closing, I want to give a hearty hello to our newest Patreon supporters, which receive monthly offerings of neo-anarchist street gear. Freshly included in this illustrious list of capable crow funders is Stephen Hattie, Mike Elston, Alexander Jury, Chuck Rogers, Bryden, Andrew Bean, and supporting us from a hidden node within a hidden grid, the one and only Justin Deal. Thank you all. Everything that you need to set up and maintain a neo-anarchist cell in your area, which at various levels now includes new stickers, patches, dice bags, fake IDs of all sorts, contact sheets for Oppie and his crew, USB cred sticks, and an upcoming album full of sixth world musical malarkey, will all be delivered to your safe house as we march bravely on. The music, serving as the background to Audible Anarchy, was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unanonium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast, and I am your host, the sacrificial signal salesman, satisfying searching Shadowrunners, schooling second-rate Sarariman, selecting, shaping, shining, and sending saucy, savory, sleek, and secure sensitive security scream sheets to safe houses, schoolhouses, shadow houses, and show houses, shelling and screaming, scheduled science scream, season to season, sans scope, seldom selfish, slapping silver-tongued spiritual spiciness, and sowing shameless sedition, and saving sold-out shorn sheep with sixth-world slang. Opti. Enjoy your freedom, or become a dragon so you can make all the rules for yourself.